Okay, here we go. Stand by.
3, 2, 1.
The Thinking Atheist. It's not a person. It's a symbol. An idea.
The population of atheists in this country is going through the roof.
Rejecting faith. Pursuing knowledge. Challenging the sacred.
If I tell the truth, it's because I tell the truth. Not because I put my hand on a book and made a wish.
And working together for a more rational world.
Take the risk of thinking for yourself. Much more happiness, truth, beauty, and wisdom will come to you that way.
Assume nothing. Question everything. And start thinking. This is the Thinking Atheist Podcast, hosted by Seth Andrews.
I guess it's the theme of this broadcast, but there's something satisfying about knowing more today than we did yesterday. And with the Great Courses Plus, this is a knowledge high that I can pretty much get anytime I want. They have over 13,000 audio and video courses to choose from the top minds and educators in their fields. It's reliable information, and with the Great Courses Plus app, you can stream to your phone, your tablet, your TV anytime you want. On this broadcast, we're talking about medicine versus myth, and the course Medical School for Everyone is just such a good fit for the show. Actually, there are three courses you can choose from. They're taught by Professor and Dr. Roy Benaroach. He has a course on pediatrics. He has one on kind of diagnoses, like we were a resident making the rounds, and a whole series on emergency medicine. This is the one I found the most useful because we've all found ourselves in those urgent moments where you got to think quickly. What are you waiting for, my friends? Sign up for the Great Courses Plus today. Start your 14-day free trial. And for a limited time, my listeners can save 20% off the annual membership. But this is only available through my special URL. Go to thegreatcoursesplus.com/Seth. Don't forget, thegreatcoursesplus.com/Seth. As proponents of science, we are big fans of medicine, like science-based medicine. But out there in the white noise of our culture, there's so much pseudoscience, bad information, hype, which is the title of the latest book from my special guest, Dr. Nina Shapiro. She is the director of pediatric otolaryngology and a professor of head and neck surgery at the David Geffen School of Medicine, UCLA. She's been featured on everything from The Early Show on CBS, CNN's Extra, National Public Radio. Her work has been published in everything from The Wall Street Journal, The LA Times, Prevention, so many others. Her books include Take a Deep Breath, which is a guide for parents. She's written a couple of books that are targeted specifically to educating pediatricians, those in the medical field, and then one for all of us. It's called Hype, A Doctor's Guide to Medical Myths, Exaggerated Claims, and Bad Advice, How to Tell What's Real and What's Not. Dr. Nina Shapiro, thanks so much for being here.
Thanks for having me. Great to talk to you.
So I've been wanting to lose weight, and I was reading online about red light therapy, like if I shine red light on myself, that I will become skinny and beautiful. And since the site says medical in the title, I'm guessing it's like, you know, an actual medical site. And this is the world that you have to deal with every single day.
I thought it was purple light, actually.
Oh,
I think there's the problem.
It may
be. If you were doing purple light therapy,
kind of a fuchsia.
You would be
kind of a fuchsia.
A shadow of your former self, exactly. Fuchsia light, there you go.
I mean, like I've heard about light therapy used for depression and other things. You know, you get into blue light and all that. But
You know, blue light is now sort of a buzzword, you know, for especially all these kids at home on their Zoom schools. And, you know, there's too much, quote unquote, blue light from the computers all day, that's supposed to be bad for you. So
is there any science behind that, to your knowledge?
There have been some studies looking at the impact of, when we say blue light, we mean a device. So a phone or an iPad or a computer, if you have too much exposure close to bedtime, it could interrupt your sleep quality. But then they started, because now everybody is on computers, there was this whole rage of, you know, blue light glasses. that if you wear these special glasses that will filter out some of the blue light, that that will all magically disappear. So what people do is they'll take a grain of truth and make it into a whole pot of rice to make it into this is the be all end all. So there is some truth to blue light, but it's not it's not the answer, and it's not certainly the source of all things evil.
Well, I didn't mean to digress too much there on the blue light, the fuchsia light.
It's not called color lights.
No, but after I'm reading your book and you start out by setting the tone, you're like, we live in the world of all these Googleable health websites. And I was curious, so after reading, I went online. And I started Googling various health subjects. One of the top offerings in my search engine was Everyday Health. It boasted trusted sources, like it had celebrity endorsements from people like musician Randy Jackson from American Idol. Apparently, he suffers from diabetes, so he was offering his advice. We had Dr. Sanjay Gupta from CNN. We had fitness trainer Jillian Michaels. They're all on this website. It's a sexy looking site, right? A whole lot sexier than cdc.gov/whatever. And so we see the science versus celebrity culture again rearing its head. You've done battle with this monster, have you not?
I have, and it is a never-ending battle. And some of the celebrity, some of the doctor celebrities, or, some of the medutainment, as they call it, there is some value to it and there is some truth to it. And if there is a good person behind a health claim, it can be helpful. The problem is that it is so tainted with sales and marketing and advertising and products that you lose the value of the information declines precipitously in sites like that. Even if there is some valuable information, it's all one big business to sell products.
So if you're in, your office or a hospital patient room or something, and somebody walks in and they printed off something from WebMD, how does that work? How does that make you as a physician? How do you react to that?
I used to take a little more concern when people would bring me information from outside. And now, if it's something like WebMD, which is on that sort of cusp of genuine, pure information with a little bit of exaggeration, I will look at it. The thing about something like WebMD, or WebMD in particular, is it does have medical information that is real. The issue is it's not meant for physicians. It's meant for non-healthcare people. So it will give you a little piece of information, not necessarily the whole story. So people tend to hold on to these little pieces of information, parts of the truth, but in part there's some truth to that. But it just gets twisted into whatever they're wanting to find. So, for instance, if there's a complication from a vaccine and it's put on WebMD and that complication really did happen, you're not necessarily going to get the whole story.
Well, that's a causation correlation issue that I know you address in the book. Someone gets the flu shot, the flu vaccine, and I got immediately sick, and I know it was the vaccine. I know the flu shot is what caused it. I'm never going to get a flu vaccine ever, ever again. I know that this is a challenge for people in the science community who are definitely faced with what has been cultivated as kind of a fear culture, especially in the last 5 years, right?
Right, and especially in the last 1 year. I never get the flu except when I get the flu shot. I never, I've gone a whole year without getting COVID, and then I got the COVID vaccine, and then I got COVID. So it's, a really, really dangerous time for any sort of vaccine hesitancy right now, because people are putting too much cause into something that is, complete correlation.
Well, to interrupt, but if somebody got the shot and had a reaction and 100,000 other people were just fine, it's the one who had the reaction that's going to make the headline, and that becomes weaponized by the merchants of disinformation.
It does, and it's very enticing. And, it's also the science behind something like that is that if you get the vaccine, you're not protected a day later. You're not protected 2 days later or even 10 days later. So in what we're seeing now are a lot of people who are getting the vaccine and they're still in the window of potentially being exposed and sick. They can get COVID even 3 weeks after their first dose because they weren't protected enough from the vaccine because it hasn't really taken effect yet.
Well, you're on the front lines in the medical community. Have you gotten the vaccine? Are you set?
I got the vaccine, I think, I didn't realize how early it was. I think I got the vaccine in the first week that it became available in this country.
So, I mean, are satellites flying over your home now? I mean, has Bill Gates showed up with his tracking devices yet? You know,
I'm actually not on a phone. I'm just speaking through the 5G through my head because I did have this implanted transmitter. It's really, really successful.
Dr. Shapiro, how does this happen? I am amazed at otherwise what I would consider to be really reasonable, intelligent people who have gotten caught up in this, don't get the shot, you'll grow a second head, you know, or it's part of an evil world order cabal of whoever that wants to take over the planet. I mean, how does this happen? You know, the conspiracy culture is just insidious. We've got 30% of Americans, 30% who say they will not get the vaccine.
30% of healthcare workers will not get the vaccine.
But no.
More terrifying. Yes.
Well, okay. How does that happen? Let's start there.
How does that happen? There's, as I said, there's always a little grain of reality that's exploded into falsehood. So, for instance, this whole idea of you'll grow a second head or you're going to have an ear coming out of your forehead is because there is this idea that it's going to alter your DNA. And the reason that became an issue is that because people heard the word mRNA, and that sounds a lot like DNA, just when you are in conversation. And if you're not up on your college or medical school biochemistry, and there's no reason anybody should, mRNA is not DNA, and this vaccine does not go into the cell nucleus, so it's nowhere near your DNA. But once people heard those words, even if we say it's not DNA, they say, oh, well, you say it could be DNA then. People twist this into this falsehood. The issue of the 5G came about when Bill Gates said that he was thinking about having what, you know, like a digital ID card, meaning that, you know, you can have some sort of identification, almost like a barcode, that you've had the vaccine, if we're going to be considering that to travel as a sort of a passport or a safety measure. And all he had to say was digital ID, and then that's what's going to happen. We're going to get implanted a digital ID in the vaccine.
Now, this plays into the type of narrative that we used to have when I was a believer, because, you know, the barcode on the forehead or on the wrist was a sign of the apocalypse and the end times. We'd linked it to the devil. So if you have an entire culture of people who are primed for apocalyptic thinking, if you talk about any kind of digital marker for access, an ID, then that's going to be the next illogical step.
Right.
Can you talk to me about herd immunity then? If a certain percentage of people are not going to get vaccinated, and the rest of us would like to get on with our lives. Like, we live in a society, we would like it to progress. I would like to be able to gather with my loved ones again. Does herd immunity happen if we have this significant percentage of people who just say no?
So it will probably happen to some degree. And because this is a novel experience that we are living through, the percent of the population that needs to be immunized in order to achieve herd immunity is an estimate at this point. So you've heard the estimate anywhere from 70% to 85% herd immunity in order for us to get back to some semblance of normal or to at least achieve a new normal. So that's what people are guessing. We're seeing in Israel's probably the best example because that country has had the highest level of vaccination in the world, that even before they're fully reaching herd immunity, they're seeing significant impact benefit-wise of the vaccine on the level of 40 to 50% of the population immunized. So that's been really positive. The only thing that we have I hate to say it, in our favor, but it is in our favor, is that a very large percentage of the population, probably much more than we even know, has had COVID. So at this early stage of the post-COVID world, we are getting a little bit of herd immunity from them because they have antibodies for now. So that's actually helping.
A lot of the work that you do is with young people.
Correct.
The narrative out there is that kids are pretty much safe from COVID, like we should open the schools, blah, blah, blah. How would you address that?
So I think young people, it's a pretty broad range. It's you know, when we think of young people, it's 0 to 18-year-olds. And teenagers, so 15 plus, 16 plus, are not too different from adults as far as their ability to transmit the virus and their ability to get sick from the virus. Certainly, they don't have evidence of being as sick as a lot of the older adults, but they can get quite sick. So the younger children definitely have a lower risk of spreading it, not zero, and a lower risk of getting it, not zero. So schools are very safe and much safer than a lot of the sort of non-regulated places that people have gone. So schools that are now and have throughout this year, and many schools have done quite well staying open all year in this country, have had very low rates because they are so careful and they have so many safety measures that are in place. And much to many people's surprise, children are actually quite able to conform to these restrictions. So children wear masks. Most people thought that children under age 8 or 10 would never wear a mask. Now we see children ages 2 years and up wearing masks, no problem. They are able to listen to directions. They're able to follow the requirements. And that has kept schools very safe. So I'm optimistic and I'm looking forward to schools. I live in Los Angeles. Our schools are not yet open. They're going to be opening in the next 3 to 4 weeks. And I'm optimistic that it's going to go actually quite well.
It must be interesting for someone who is spending hours upon hours in surgery, fully masked, listening to people talk about how they can't breathe in masks.
You would have a lot of dead surgeons on your hand if that were an issue. I mean, not only are we wearing masks, we're wearing masks in general in a very tight environment with, you know, there's okay circulation, but, you know, we don't have our windows open in the operating rooms. We're under hot lights. Oftentimes we have 2 masks plus a headlight plus goggles plus a face shield. It's not new to us. So, the notion of I'm going to suffocate and I'm going to retain carbon dioxide and my oxygen is going to drop, I think that was hopefully debunked pretty early, although people still have these subjective complaints. And a lot of that is just feeling claustrophobic, a little anxiety. But, you know, there's no evidence and no medical or scientific evidence that a mask is going to cause any problems. It gives you a little bad skin, gives you, what do they call it, maskne.
Yeah.
But that's just for those N95s that we wear, I think.
Okay, before I finally jump into your book, I have one last related question. I had read a statistic, and you can tell me if you've seen this out there, that with everybody or a significant number of people wearing masks, we've seen a tremendous decrease in cases of the flu.
It is remarkable. We've seen almost no flu. I mean, not zero, but as close. This is a remarkable year. I hate to use the word unprecedented. I'm tired of that word, but I'm finding
fits.
A new one. Remarkable, unprecedented, that we are not seeing the flu. We are not seeing common colds. We're not seeing much of any respiratory illness in general that we would normally see in a winter season. So masks have had added benefits that we weren't planning on, especially in children. You know, children are notorious for spreading bugs and germs and getting sick all winter and getting their parents sick and getting everyone else sick. And that's been extremely low this year.
I wonder if we'll end up sort of metamorphosizing as a society to be a little more like Japan, where they wear masks quite often and as a result avoid some of these sort of flu-like issues that we have.
I think so. I think, you know, a lot of people are asking, so when are masks going to be gone? Is that going to eventually fade out and we can go back to not wearing masks? And, I think the answer is yes, they will be gone at some level, but I agree. I think that we may wear masks in the winter months or wear masks in public transportation in the winter months. Or if you have a cold, you wear a mask, and it'll be sort of common decency if people have such a thing. So I think we may incorporate them into our world, and then I think that'll actually be good. I think doctor's offices may require people to wear masks when they come to the doctors or visit somebody in the hospital. I mean, it makes sense.
I saw a meme online that said, you know, if you're kind of a funny looking person, but you have great eyes, this is your season, right? I mean, the mask is, this is your destiny kind of thing.
So. It's perfect. It's perfect. And it's funny because a lot of my friends, and, you know, because we've been obviously working and wearing masks, it's, we're very focused on our eye makeup more than ever before.
It's
that's your only chance.
Almost kind of a, you know.
You don't have to worry about lips. No lipstick, no, you know, just maybe some chapstick if you're, you know, your lips are dry, but it's all about the eyes.
Let's talk about the book. Funny. It's called Hype, A Doctor's Guide to Medical Myths, Exaggerated Claims, and Bad Advice, How to Tell What's Real and What's Not. Dr. Nina Shapiro, how do you handle the it worked for me arguments? And here's an example. So I injured my back, you know, typical middle-aged stuff. I end up in physical therapy. And amid all the other stuff that he was doing, he recommended dry needling. So they take these long needles and they jam them into the muscles of my back. And I'm a pilgrim in a strange land. I don't really know what's going on, but what the hell? Let's give it a shot. And I came back and started finally doing some digging on this. And I didn't discover much, if any, real science behind it. But a ton of people said, oh, I did it and it worked for me. And so in the culture of personal anecdotes, you know, I tried this. I tried purple light therapy. It worked for me. How do you approach that?
Well, if it's a patient asking or if it's a friend asking, you know, there are a couple different levels. So the one is it worked for me and it's harmless. Didn't hurt you. Didn't hurt anybody. You got better. Great. So a lot of this nonsense or this, you know, alternative or complementary stuff that's not necessarily nonsense, but is not necessarily grounded in any sort of science. If it works for one person and it didn't hurt anybody and they don't mind the extra expense, because it's usually a financial cost as well, it's usually okay. But the problem is when people say it worked for me or it didn't work for me, if it's something that's actually helpful, then it gets a little bit dangerous because it's based on nothing. And it can hurt other people. So, you know, I didn't get the flu shot and I've never gotten the flu. That works for me. That's dangerous. Or I haven't gotten COVID and I haven't worn a mask and that works for me. So I'm not going to do it. That gets dangerous. So, you know, I think a lot of this stuff that is a little bit out there is preying on people who have pain is one of the most common reasons that people would seek out alternative therapy. And it preys on your fear, it preys on your pain, and it is very, very seductive, and it is very effective.
Aren't people kind of vulnerable when they're desperate? They're grasping for hope. There's a young woman in my circle. She's not even 40, diagnosed with stage 4 esophageal cancer. And she's trying to eat her way through the cancer. And, you know, she distrusts what she calls Western medicine. I think what you and I would just call medicine, right? Because I think in the East, they're practicing the same medicine that doctors are practicing here. But in her mind, you know, pharmaceutical bad, natural good. I'm going to eat kale and drink juice. And this then distracts her from science-based treatments. And it's probably making somebody else rich.
It's brilliant. And it does. As you said, it preys on fear. It preys on the vulnerable. It preys on people's pocketbooks. And people will literally spend their final savings for themselves and for their families on these health spas, wellness centers that will claim to cure them or rid them of their ails. And it's dangerous. It's illegal. And, you know, if you look closely at a lot of these places that are claiming to, you know, cure you of your cancer using, you know, a vitamin or, you know, a sauna or a kale supplement. A lot of the owners and purveyors of these have lost their medical licenses, have several multiple charges against them. If you dig a little deeper, then again, because of Google, it's pretty easy to find, but you can't see it from their beautiful website or from their spa. So it's very effective and it's very dangerous. And I think people really, when they don't have an answer from medicine, we'll just call it medicine, not allopathic or Western, it's just medicine, they will find something that will give them an answer, even if the answer is fake.
I've seen people leave the country and they go down to like freaking Tijuana, you know, where they're doing coffee enemas and whatnot, and they're paying tens of thousands of dollars because they believe that these procedures, really unregulated procedures done without much accountability at all, they're going to save their lives. And I'm interested in how they only hear about the success stories, and the success stories are coming from the people who are selling the treatment. You know what I'm saying? It's like a casino. They never broadcast the losers on the big digital marquee. It's only the guy who rolled the dice and won $10,000. You're familiar with these sort of hole-in-the-wall places in other countries?
Sure. In other countries and in our country. And, you know, you don't have to go to tea. You can come to Santa Monica for a coffee enema.
No thanks.
I'm out. That's Gwyneth Paltrow. That's her area.
What's that supposed to do? I mean, what is coffee in that part
goodness.
Of the body?
So helpful. It leaches out the evil humors, and it's, you know, it's nothing. But all you have to do is say these really nice words, and you have a beautiful website, and you should see these spas that are, you know, they're never going to be, with all due respect, in the middle of northern Michigan. They're going to be in Palm Desert or in Mexico or, you know, in some beautiful resort-type community to lure people there. And I don't know about you, but if I go to a spa for 3 days or 5 days and you know, drink nice juice and you know, sit in the sunshine, I'm going to feel pretty great. And there's a lot to be said for that as a compliment to traditional care. But people who have no options or people who put aside the reality of medical treatment and undergo these interventions that are really just spa, you know, glorified health spas, they'll feel better temporarily.
Some of that's probably got something to do with the personal attention, right? Someone's there, they make
pampering,
you feel like...
Sure.
Yeah. You feel like the center of the universe, and a lot of these therapies involve touch and the things that we as human beings respond to positively, and I mean, usually positively. So I find that interesting.
Right. Pre-pandemic. Yeah, and people really do fall for this, but it is quite scary how people really do get tricked. And you know, this is not covered by insurance. It's, you know, tens of thousands of dollars that people are sinking in a, you know, a very short period of time. And it really does prey on their desperation. And a large part of it is placebo effect, which is not fake. It's a true physiologic improvement that you can experience, whether it's from a quote-unquote sugar pill or some intervention that's not a true medical intervention. And the placebo effect can be very helpful, especially when there's no option. But it's a pretty expensive placebo that people are receiving.
That would be one of the arguments, supposed arguments in its favor, though. I mean, if the body responds positively, even if it's only sugar or water or light, hey, it's still a positive response. Therefore, you have validated our procedure.
Well, I think, you know, if it's something that is a subjective issue, so for that, I mean, headaches, pain, things like that, where it's not like a tumor or something that has to be treated more definitively, if needling helps your pain, then that's great, assuming you don't have a tumor that's not being treated in your back. Or, you know, if a spa treatment treats your headache and you don't have a brain tumor or an aneurysm, then that's certainly fine.
Can you give me some examples of other medical myths or claims that are just sort of way beyond the pale, that go way beyond the reality? I mean, yeah, I'm not asking you to read your book for us, but give me some of the greatest hits.
I think that a lot of people hold on to a few areas where they can control and use that as the answer, or the answer to the problem, or the problem itself. So one is diet. That's a big one. that I stopped eating gluten and X, Y, and Z happened, or I stopped having dairy and X, Y, and Z happened. And, you know, certainly it's everyone's diet is very important, and it's important to have a healthy diet depending on who you are and where you live and your age and your health status. But people put so much emphasis on it and how it impacts every other aspect of their life that it becomes all-consuming, so to speak, and exaggerated. And that's, you know, one of the things I sort of try to emphasize in the book is that there's not a lot of what people think and do. It's not that it's wrong or it's bad or it's just, you know, terrible, but it's exaggerated. So certainly dairy can have some little bit of issues, but it's not necessarily the evil of the world. And, you know, same for gluten, unless you are truly gluten intolerant or have celiac disease, which is a disease where you can't digest gluten. But people put so much effort and emphasis on their diet being the answer to every health aspect that, you know, I find that kind of interesting. And they spend a lot of money and time and energy paying people to help them with their diet or going on certain diets and these fad diets that are never going to be long lasting. And, you know, it's a big, big business. That and supplements. Supplements are another one. And that came about big time in COVID, that if you take, you know, high dose this, high dose that, come to a vitamin infusion center, that's going to protect you from COVID and treat your COVID. And, you know, certainly it's important to have vitamins in your diet, but they are not going to fix everything.
I've made so many trips to the grocery store. You look at the packaging, non-GMO, gluten-free, right? On almost everything. And of course, the GMO question brings us back to the whole vaccine thing. You know, people are worried. Well, a genetically modified means it's Frankenfood. And I'm thinking to myself, when did we get there? You know, the point where natural good, modified bad, sometimes they're modified for the better.
I would absolutely agree. A lot of the genetic modification is to, for instance, minimize need for pesticides. Well, that sounds pretty good. Or maybe it'll have more concentrated vitamin content, or maybe the food will be more prolific so it will feed more people. And there are a lot of hungry people on this planet that need food and can't get it. So there's a lot of benefit to genetic modification. I think it gets mixed up with processed and chemicals and preservatives, and that all equals bad. But, you know, some of the genetic modification has actually made food a lot healthier and a lot safer.
Isn't everything chemical?
Yeah, chemical. I mean, it's a funny word because hydrogen is a chemical and water is a chemical. H2O is a molecule. And those words become mixed with quote unquote bad chemicals or unhealthy chemicals. But yes, everything is a chemical and everything is an ingredient. I think that, you know, people get a little bit mixed. And again, the packaging, as you mentioned in the grocery store, the front of the package, which is what the sellers want everybody to see, is much less telling than the actual list of ingredients and list of nutrients and how much is really beneficial in it. But the, you know, the marketing stuff on the front is really just, it's just marketing.
I mean, it looks so healthy, you know, and there's a 70 something year old farmer and he's in his cornfield and the sun is shining on the box. And that's just, that sounds really wholesome to me. And that's the kind of stuff.
You sold me. Yeah.
All right, my friends, we're just getting warmed up. We've got many more medical myths with Dr. Nina Shapiro coming up next. Hang on. Patrons get the show early and commercial free. And thanks so much for your support. Patreon.com/Seth Andrews. Talking here with my special guest, physician, educator, and author, Dr. Nina Shapiro. Her website is drninashapiro.com. Give me some other examples if you have them, medical myths or exaggerated claims.
I think vaccine, you know, I still will go back to vaccines because that's really the issue of the moment, you know, the exaggerated claims of vaccines causing problems, vaccines causing autism. And it's funny, we're not really hearing a lot about vaccines and autism these days because we're so focused on this vaccine for adults. But the cause from vaccines and the negative from vaccines is so much more played in the media than the benefits. And, you know, something that we don't talk about and that we really didn't talk about until this year is what the impact of not having a vaccine can do. And we've seen that in the last 13 months, what not having a COVID vaccine can do to this planet and what having a vaccine can do. And because most of us haven't lived through a pandemic and very few of us remember polio, we don't really appreciate how revolutionary and life-saving vaccines are. They're just a nuisance and something that is, you know, some sort of toxin or poison that we are being forced to take.
Well, you brought up vaccines. All right. Can we camp out on Andrew Wakefield, publisher of some very, very bad quote-unquote research linking vaccines to autism? Can you sort of lay this out in general terms for the audience, sort of at least one of the genesis points of a huge misinformation campaign, vaccines and autism?
Sure. So Andrew Wakefield did a very small study looking at children who had an issue with their intestines, and part of the measles vaccine was thought to trigger a reaction, a gastrointestinal stomach reaction, an intestinal reaction that led to and propagated developmental issues, which were not even called autism at the time. And then all of a sudden, it became an issue that this vaccine was triggering developmental issues. So even if that were the case, it was a very small study. But not only that, the study was falsified. The data was not even real. So his study was pulled from a very reputable journal, The Lancet. And we actually, I can't remember the date, but we in medicine celebrate Retraction Day every year.
Really?
As sort of, yes, an homage to the journal that was smart enough to retract it and not just write an editorial and say that this, you know, the data was not accurate. They pulled it from their journal. So, and then he lost his medical license. So he's really, you know, not a credible source. He's very charismatic and has very, very powerful people on his side and, you know, continue to support him. There have been movies made about him. Del Bigtree is a producer who made a movie sort of supporting Andrew Wakefield's ideas. Jenny McCarthy, a well-known comedian, and she's actually quite funny and a good actress, had a child with developmental disorder and attributed it to vaccines. So she was a big supporter of Andrew Wakefield. And, you know, so he has some very powerful people, and that has continued into a whole area, groups of people who believe this stuff.
It's almost like inertia has taken over. You know, it's the headline gets all the press, the retraction gets buried on page 20, you know, below the classified ads. Then you've got this quote unquote documentary out there like Vaxxed. And people who are already primed for fear and conspiracy, they just latch right onto it. And then when you bring the retraction, they're not all that interested. And that's got to be frustrating.
Right, because then it was, oh, well, those scientists, they just pulled it because, you know, they don't want him to get all of this notoriety. And they, you know, they're just these scientists that don't really know what they're doing, and they're, you know, in it, you know, they're getting funded by pharmaceutical companies, so of course they're going to pull it. So, you know, the lack of trust is astounding, you know, when it comes to doctors and researchers.
Talking here with Dr. Nina Shapiro, let's talk about homeopathy. This is an interesting one because, as I understand it, and I've talked to people like the late James Randi and others who've done experiments on stage with homeopathic medicines, I'm using that word loosely, but the more diluted it is, the more effective it is. Can you take us into this little sandbox, Dr. Shapiro?
Right. So homeopathy was developed in the late 18th century by a man named Hahnemann. And there's actually a medical school named for him in Philadelphia, Hahnemann School. And the notion was exactly that. If you take a little bit, a tincture, a tiny bit of some sort of material, it will actually cure the issue. So in some ways, that starts to sound like a vaccine. So you take a little bit of a virus and you inject it, and then you get a little bit of reaction similar to the illness, and it prevents it. So a lot of people who are anti-vax say, well, how could you be against homeopathy? That's how vaccines were. And it's really not the case. Homeopathy really is nothing. There's really very little in any of these potions that will do anything to you, except potentially harm you if it's a really dangerous substance and it's given, you know, in too high a dilution. But it's placebo is what it is.
Yeah, those who talk about alternative medicine as opposed to medicine sort of talk about it like Robin Hood, you know, going up against the man. And I just found this really bizarre, considering that alternative medicine and the health and wellness industry is like a multi-billion dollar industry.
I think it's in the trillions. I think the wellness industry in and of itself is in the trillions.
I mean, you know, this is not like someone went out and stuck it to the man. I feel like, you know, in some ways they just found another man. That's a terrible analogy, but
It's a great analogy, and it's true. I mean, it seems sweeter and it seems softer, you know, and it seems like the purchaser is more in control, but it's complete sham and scam and, you know, a financial sink for many people, millions of people, obviously. But, you know, it just feels nicer. It feels cleaner that, you know, people are really more apt to that, especially if they've had something that hasn't responded to medicine, or if they have a chronic issue that hasn't responded, and then they engage in some sort of alternative practice and they feel better. You know, what I've noticed that was interesting over the past year is that when COVID first hit, all of a sudden, doctors were cool again, or maybe we were cool for the first time, but people were clapping for us and people were calling us heroes. And, you know, we had a placard on our front lawn that friends laughed. You know, it was really, you know, in New York City, everyone at 7 o'clock at night would come out and applaud the healthcare workers. And nobody was, the alternative medicine folks were pretty quiet because they knew they had nothing on this COVID thing. And, you know, we were all of a sudden, it was okay to be treated by a doctor because you knew that if you were sick, you needed to go to an ICU, not to a spa. And now that people are getting better and we're starting to see some light at the end of the tunnel, they're creeping back in to sort of contest the idea of the vaccines. But they were pretty quiet for a while, for a few months, actually.
I'm going to say two words that I'm tying into chapter 10 of your book. Big Pharma. When I say those two words, I just feel like there's a cabal of mustache twirlers and they're filling their pockets and they're in the business of trying to keep people sick because the more you need the meds, the more rich they get, blah, blah, blah. Big Pharma evil. What do you do with that, Dr. Nina Shapiro?
You know, it's tough because there has been a lot of unnecessary money making in Big Pharma. And, you know, there are a lot of expenses that are completely unnecessary. But when it comes to, you know, marketing, for instance, is a huge, you know, you just have to watch one network television show to learn about every single, you know, infection that you're going to get from your rheumatoid arthritis medicine.
Ask your doctor if medicine X is right for you. Yeah. Yeah.
Yes, and you could die and get a tumor and have a horrible fungal infection, but take this medicine. But when it comes to vaccines, they are specifically an extremely low moneymaker. They don't make money. Doctors don't make money on vaccines. Pharmaceutical companies make very little money on vaccines compared to other medications that are so widely used, including supplements, by the way, trillions of dollars. But vaccines themselves, which people claim to be, you know, big money makers, are not. They take, except for this vaccine, because people worked, you know, they had thousands and thousands of people working 24/7 all over the world to develop the coronavirus vaccine. In general, vaccine technology takes years. It's very poorly funded. Nobody really cares if, you know, some kids have a diarrheal illness in, you know, some country they've never heard of. So vaccine science is very challenging. It's very slow moving, and it's not Big Pharma. That's not what people, if people are concerned about Big Pharma, they should go to supplements.
Well,
that's the scam.
Yeah, but I mean, beyond vaccines, which we've talked a lot about, I mean, there's a host of non-vaccine a host of non-vaccine medications that are often extremely expensive. You know, like people are having to navigate, will my insurance pay this? And what's the copay? And it's in hundreds of dollars and I can't afford it, blah, blah, blah. So this shifts the focus back on, you know, somebody's getting rich, or that's the narrative out there. How would you approach that?
You know, that's a, I agree. It's a mess. And, you know, if you have an ulcer and, you know, gastric ulcer and you need to take some medication and you're going to have to put your house on the market to afford your medication, it's ridiculous. I mean, that's not just big pharma, that's health insurance companies. And, you know, where the money is being inappropriately spent, I agree, that's a big problem. You know, that's a bigger problem than just big pharma, actually, because then, you know, then we start getting into health insurance and how that works and, you know, how people are price gouged and what it costs to set foot in an emergency room, you know, without even getting treatment. And, you know, that's a big problem with healthcare in general. And again, that's not just big pharma.
You don't have to answer this question. I know that, you know, I'm putting you on the spot. Nationalized healthcare? You're a physician. Do you have a perspective?
I have a little bit of a perspective because I did spend some time in England as a doctor, and I saw the pros and the cons of nationalized healthcare. And I have friends who are in Canada, and I see the pros and the cons of nationalized healthcare or single-payer system. And there are obviously significant benefits to that go, you know, unsaid, you know, that everybody would get care and that you don't have to pay and that there's no fee and everybody will get good medical care. But the reality is it's not, even nationalized healthcare, especially in a country like this, will not be that. It will still be tiered. There will still be the haves and the have-nots. And unfortunately, it will become even more of a discrepancy between the two groups.
I'm very much a fan of seeing healthcare as part of society, part of our infrastructure. I mean, in philosophy, I really do agree. I do have worries that we tend to think public good, private bad, and the idea that a government-run mechanism for healthcare would not be loaded as well with red tape and bureaucracy and even rampant waste, simply because, I mean, we've seen a lot of waste in other types of government. I still, in my own life, support the idea of like a nationalized or some sort of a system where we consider healthcare a right. Right? Gun ownership is a right, but healthcare is not in this country. That's a problem for me. So, I mean, that's probably more of a philosophical question. But you're saying that you're not convinced that if we go national with the government running everything, that we still wouldn't face many of the same problems we're facing privatized.
Exactly. There will always be privatization. And I think what would happen is the privatization would become more higher echelon socioeconomic groups, wealthier people, and, oh, you want to have a hip replacement, you can wait 3 months. But if you have $300,000 to give to this medical facility, we can get it done next week.
Well,
it's going to cause more, you know, in a country like ours, where we are a capitalist country and the socioeconomics of, you know, healthcare access and healthcare disparity are as drastically unfair as they are now, I think it would become magnified, unfortunately.
Well, we could do a whole show on that. I didn't mean to digress too much.
No, all good.
Any other, you know, medical myths, anything that's floating around out there that you think should be addressed?
Well, you know, masks are, you know, what people are talking about now are really, you know, how do we get back to life? You know, do we need masks? Are masks nonsense? You know, they told us there was nonsense and then they told us it wasn't nonsense. You know, where is the truth in that? I hear a lot of people, you know, still thinking that masks are a waste. So that's interesting. I think that's going to continue to be debated even after we have herd immunity from COVID. Marijuana is a very interesting issue going on currently, you know, at least in my part of the country, you know, legalized to some degree. It's still very, very stigmatized. So people are very comfortable telling their physician how much alcohol they drink or how much they, you know, how many, you know, packs of cigarettes they smoke, but are very, very uncomfortable mentioning if they use marijuana, whether for medical or for other reasons. So that's kind of an interesting twist.
As we see, though, the ubiquity of weed in the United States, I do find it ironic that we have for so long allowed alcohol, we don't even blink. Everybody loses their mind about recreational drugs like marijuana. I myself have a hard time sort of differentiating the two. As a physician, do you have that discussion?
Well, we do more so now. Just be, again, I take care of children, so
yeah. Well, I would hope that's not a problem.
Maybe the 18, 21-year-olds.
Yeah.
And then the others just don't say. So, you know, but obviously I talk to friends and parents of my patients. And, you know, I think it's a socially it's still more socially acceptable to drink alcohol in public, share alcohol. Alcohol is just part of our culture as a social entity. And marijuana is still considered either a medical intervention, which is being more accepted, or something that is used by, you know, teenagers who are sneaking around, you know, during lunch period in high school. I think it still has that connotation. It's going to take a while. It may take another generation, you know, the upcoming generation, the Gen Z, to, I'll say normalize it, but to destigmatize it.
Can you help me understand, like, the CBD thing? People are giving their pets CBD oil. Have you dipped your toe into that? Can you speak to it at all?
I mean, I think, you know, a lot of that, you can buy it at the airport, you can get it, you know, it used to be like, oh my gosh, I found a pot shop, and now it's just, you know, you go to LAX and they have it in the kiosks. And, you know, I think that's a little bit of hype as far as,
I mean, is the science there?
Anybody. I don't know. It's a pretty soft call. I mean, some parts of marijuana are really good for nausea and for relaxation that won't necessarily get you quote unquote high. But, you know, the CBD oil, I don't know if there's any evidence of benefit to your dog or, you know, to your pasta more so than extra virgin olive oil. Maybe there is, but I think, you know, most of that at this point is, you know, a little bit of just a very seductive, very smart marketing tool at this point. It's probably not dangerous, but, you know, the actual benefit that they're claiming is probably quite exaggerated.
You said something interesting. Some would consider scandalous. Other people would consider heaven sent in your book when you say that, you know, you may not need as much exercise as everybody says you need. I've always heard like 30 minutes a day, strenuous exercise, or three times a week, you know, and then drink a gallon of water. I mean, these are the things that we have been taught. Is this not correct?
Well, some of it is based on science and some of it is based on non-science. So, for instance, drinking a certain, you know, 8 glasses of water a day, I think that was what was going around. And that was based on somebody who posted something, not posted on social media, but wrote something around, you know, soon after World War II, that this was a healthy amount of water intake per day. But what they cut out from the soundbite was that most of that can be found in foods that we eat. So most foods, even if they seem quite dry, have a very, very high water content. And that counts as water intake. Most fruits and vegetables are about 90%+ water. So if you eat, you know, a fruit or a vegetable, that's like having 2 glasses of water or 4 glasses of water. So you don't necessarily need to, you know, you see these people with, you know, used to be the portable water bottle was a new thing. Now you see these portable water coolers. It looks like the size of what people flip over and have in the office, these like 1 gallon things that people are supposed to drink all day. I think a lot of that is to, you know, make you feel full. So you won't eat as much. So it's sort of a diet. But, you know, if you ask a kidney specialist, you know, you need to do that. They would say, what, you don't trust your kidneys? Your kidneys will figure out when you're thirsty, and that's fine. That's how our bodies work. We don't give our internal organs enough credit.
But don't we drink a lot of water so that we can detox? I don't know how many people I've heard say, well, you know, I need to flush the toxins
out
of my system. And I do that through food and water and maybe sunlight and exercise. Toxins?
Or coffee enema. That does it too. Right. So we have toxins in our body. And that's why we have kidneys and intestines. It's pretty cool.
Wait,
and we have sweat glands.
Wait, I can't detox? You know, like if I do a regimen, I'm not detoxing. If I take a supplement, I'm not detoxing. I mean, how do we approach these claims?
They are claims. You are not detoxing. And again, a lot of people will say, I feel great after I did my juice cleanse detox. And, you know, you probably do because a lot of that stuff is pretty healthy, but it's not necessarily going to do anything physiologically long term or even short term. So, you know, there's a fair amount of nonsense to that.
Well, I look forward to the hate mail that you're going to get in your email inbox for saying something like that. I mean, as we get close to the end of our discussion here, Dr. Nina Shapiro, what kind of feedback are you getting? You know, you're probably getting some hate mail or at least people who are saying that you're wrong. I don't know. What's the temperature?
Oh, I have gotten a lot of hate mail. It's actually interesting to see what really triggers people because I'm active on social media. I'm a contributor for Forbes and I, you know, write this book. So, you know, I say what I feel, and I feel like it's based on science and evidence-based medicine. And I get a lot of, it's interesting. I would say probably the harshest hate mail I ever got was about something I wrote about alkaline water being a waste of money. And I thought it was clever because I said it's basically a waste of money. See what I did there? Basic.
Oh, yeah. Medical basically. Humor. Yeah.
Alkaline. Yeah. Pretty funny. So, yeah. So I just said it's, you know, your body, your kidneys are going to, and your gastrointestinal system are going to neutralize to your pH no matter what you eat. If you eat acidic, spicy food, you don't develop acidic internal organs or acidic blood. You know, your body is able to accommodate for that. And that goes for alkaline water or, you know, these oxygenated waters and black water, I think was another one. And it's fine, but it's a waste of money. Don't waste your money. Drink water, drink juice, you know, drink coffee, drink milk, whatever you want to drink. But, you know, if you want to waste your money on, you know, a $13 bottle of water, it is a waste of money. And I got chewed up alive. And, you know, it's fine. People, you know, people who are, you know, in that business, you know, don't like to hear that. And they don't like that to be publicized.
You know what? You're just a shell of Big Pharma. You're just, you know, it's, you're the man. And they're going to stick it to the man.
Yes. I get called that all the time.
I will link to your book in the description box of this show, and I encourage everybody. Not only is it hugely informative and well-sourced, but it's also a fun read, which is not often the case with medical texts, Dr. Shapiro. You know, a lot of that stuff's really egg-heady and thick. I mean, it's loaded with information, but we civilians tend to glaze over. But your book seems to be written for people like me, and I really appreciate that. If you were to sort of, I don't know, pitch it, sell it, sum it up, if I could get you to talk about why it's a book worth reading, what would you say to the audience?
I would say that this book, Hype, is a way, it helps people navigate the breakneck health information that is coming at us on a daily basis. It gives the reader tools to help decipher what they're hearing, what they're reading, how to check their sources, how to check the sources of their sources, no matter what the topic happens to be, if it's supplements or diet or vaccines or internet health information or how to assess what's a good doctor and what's not a good doctor for you. So it really just provides the reader tools to navigate our voluminous information coming at us every day.
The book is called Hype, A Doctor's Guide to Medical Myths, Exaggerated Claims, and Bad Advice, How to Tell What's Real and What's Not. Dr. Nina Shapiro, it's 7 o'clock tonight. I'm going to go out in my yard and just clap my hands and give you the applause like the people in New York are doing for the medical.
Thank you. A hero.
Dedicated to our medical heroes. You are always such a great guest.
You.
All success with the book. And I look forward to talking again on the show. Thanks again.
Thank you. Have a great day.
Follow The Thinking Atheist on Facebook and Twitter. For a complete archive of podcasts and videos, products like mugs and t-shirts featuring the Thinking Atheist logo, links to atheist pages and resources, and details on upcoming free thought events and conventions, log on to our website, thethinkingatheist.com.